Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about, from Washington University, living cartilage grown using stem cells could prevent any more hip replacement surgery. And from Johns Hopkins University, new evidence how amino acid cysteine combats Huntington's disease. And University of California, Davis, why you should be eating walnuts all the time. And University of Pittsburgh, overlook benefits of successful healthy lifestyle, meaning the healthier diet and your lifestyle, the better the quality of life overall. So what does that mean for people not engaging in a healthy lifestyle? It means not a happy life. Also today, our conclusion of the in-depth original investigative report white paper, The Injection Deception, Deconstructing the Science of Vaccine Efficacy. And I'm asking for people, please send this to all the different vaccine advocacy groups, health advocates, everyone you know, because this is how we, the people, share insights and information that the mainstream media would never even look at, let alone give us a forum to share. In light of that, the latest on mandatory vaccines and the eliminating philosophical exemptions is moving forward in the Ohio legislature and many others around the country. And behind it all, I believe, is ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, working on behalf of the pharmaceutical companies. And they want to see that what went on in California is in every state. So we'll deal with that. Also, just to give you a very personal, up-close look at what it means to trust the vaccine that you're using, the doctor, the pharmacist, the nurse. We're going to hear about Jamie's son and what happened when they trusted the vaccines, and I think it's compelling. Also today, the U.S. puts more people in prison than any other country in the world. And why? Well, let's start with profit, and we'll deal with that on today's program. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. First up, this is from the University of California, Davis. Researchers at the university and other institutions have found that diets rich in whole walnuts or walnut oil slowed prostate cancer growth in this laboratory experiment. In addition, both walnuts and the walnut oil reduce cholesterol and increase insulin sensitivity. That's good for diabetics and pre-diabetics. The walnut diet also reduced levels of hormone IGF-1. Now that's good because when that IGF-1 hormone is elevated, that's your insulin growth factor 1, which milk does the same thing, by the way. That's why I suggest people not drink milk. It's implicated in both breast cancer and prostate cancer. And this was published in the Journal of Medicinal Food, quote, from the study, "For years, the United States government has been on a crusade against fat, and I think it's been to our detriment," says the lead scientist, Paul Davis, walnuts are a perfect example. While they are high in fat, their fat does not drive prostate cancer growth. In fact, walnuts do just the opposite. So, and he is right. So the good fats you can enjoy, as people all over the world have, especially in the Mediterranean, where they eat a lot of fat, but it's healthy fat. We eat the wrong fat. We eat the animal fats. University of Pittsburgh did a study, and they wanted to know, what is the value of a healthy lifestyle? And they found, wow, it's big. In an analysis published in the current issue of Quality in Life Research, the scientists showed that participation in a community-based behavioral lifestyle intervention program to improve health not only helped people lose weight and decrease blood pressure and increase their physical activity and also reduce their diabetes and reduce their heart disease, but also increase their health-related quality of life substantially. And this was through the National Institutes of Health. Quote, these community-based lifestyle intervention programs have additional value benefits beyond the improvement of risk factors for type 2 diabetes and heart disease. Our study demonstrates that these programs, delivered in diverse community settings such as senior centers and work sites, simultaneously and significantly improve the quality of life of the participants. Well, I would agree with that. In fact, we have seen in over 40 health support groups, some as small as, 50 people, some as large as 1,500 people, that people come, yes, because they want to get healthy and have a support system, but it's that support system, knowing that someone is there to support you in the changes you're about to make, especially if you don't feel fully confident or have all the knowledge you need in order to make an easy transition. That's one of the reasons a lot of people stay on a meat-based diet or high-sugar diet, unless they have someone in their support system working with them. And so what I suggested, and this was about 3 years ago, I suggested that the person who is the caregiver or the partner in a relationship where their partner is not healthy, come with them and be a support system and create little circles of a buddy system, 5 people per person. So if you ever have a problem, if you ever need someone to talk with, if you ever had an issue you couldn't resolve, if you felt depressed one day, you've got 5 different people you can call, and they'll be there to help you get through that little hiccup and that happens in our lives. And it works so well, and this was just for arthritis, that we were able to reverse completely full-blown arthritis. You couldn't even get into the study unless you had arthritis for 7 years. One had arthritis for 27 years. And because of this buddy system and supporting other healthy changes, we had a 92% success rate, meaning 92% of the people no longer have arthritis, pain, inflexible joints. All that changed in 28 days. And we checked with all the scientific literature. In fact, we had an outside medical biostatistician who took almost 3 months to review all the world literature to see, did anyone ever do this? And the answer was no one had ever done this before. So it was one of those very important studies. And a crucial part of it was the people were not making changes alone. And that's what this is saying. The communities making changes together can frequently have far more success. And it also then helps people start doing more things. Because if you're depressed and sedentary and watching television or surfing the internet all day, and suddenly you're asked to participate in with a group, with other people, first you engage, you communicate, you share your thoughts, and next thing you know, you're starting to do things with other people supporting because they're doing it also. And so you gave up dairy, and the next week you gave up meat, and the next week you gave up sugar, and the next week and within a year, you've made all these wonderful changes. You've lost weight. You have energy galore. And now you're more likely to go out and do other healthy things. That's why we should be paying a lot of attention to what happens when you become a vegan, a conscious vegan. Not just a political vegan, but a conscious, where you're doing it for all the right reasons. You're going to be far more likely to look at everything else in life with that broader perspective, which means you're going to be actively doing many more healthy things than you had before. So that's why I really support the idea of support systems. New evidence from Johns Hopkins University published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They report they've identified a biochemical pathway linking oxidative stress and the amino acid cysteine in Huntington's disease. And because cysteine, C-Y-S-T-E-I-N-E, cysteine deficiency, which is common, and oxidative stress, that's what happens when you, well, when you just normally live, or you're going to have oxidative stress. But if you're in a polluted environment with air pollution, that really increases oxidative stress. If you're in a moldy environment, a damp environment, an overly humid environment, oxidative stress. If you're exercising vigorously, oxidative stress. All these things cause oxidative stress. And that is linked with other diseases like Alzheimer's, arthritis, cardiovascular disease, cancer. And that's what the investigators found. So, by taking in the amino acid cysteine, you're able to help block that process. So, if you know someone with Huntington's disease, suggest that they review the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, the current issue, and they will find a study of how cysteine made a difference, and that difference could help a lot of them from suffering. Now, there's a lot of people in America who've had hip replacement, or they can't exercise because it's bone on bone. This is from Washington University, and this is really good news. This was also published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. That's our most august, respected peer review center in America. When you publish in it, it's good. Quote, researchers reveal how it may be possible to use a patient's own stem cells to grow new cartilage in the shape of a hip joint. Furthermore, the team, including researchers from Washington University School of Medicine, say it's possible to program the newly grown cartilage to release anti-inflammatory molecules, which would stave off the return of arthritis, the most common cause of hip pain. According to the National Institute of Arthritis, Musculoskeletal and Skin Diseases, osteoarthritis is the primary cause of hip joint damage that requires hip replacement surgery, causing severe pain and disability. And they're using this stem cell. So that's good. Now, here's some extra information they're not aware of. You can actually stimulate your own body's stem cells by taking in wheatgrass, barley grass, also spirulina and chlorella. Mix it all together. That actually stimulates natural stem cells. So that's why those who were following the Ann Wigmore protocol, she founded Hippocrates Institute, and she was a wonderful human being. I remember once I was up at my farm, the old Healing Springs Ranch. No, excuse me, this was the Fertiler Farm upstate. And she came by once. She was on her way from Boston, and she wanted to drop in, and we had a couple-hour chat about what was new and what she was finding out, and she was increasing the amount of wheatgrass she was having people take every day. And I asked her, I said, are you going to start to spread out from this monotheistic principle that there's one thing that does everything when there's a whole lot of everythings that do a lot? But she was stuck on wheatgrass, and that was it. And her center is still in operation today. In fact, recently I was lecturing in Orlando, and a person came over who runs the Ann Wigmore Healing Center down in Puerto Rico. And they said, she said, we're doing fine. You know, people come there and they detox. It's a rather Spartan product program, but it's a nice pretty environment. And the woman who founded it, forgotten today by most people or unknown by younger people, but she was a true pioneer. If she'd be around today, she'd be the first saying, hey, do you see this work that you can stimulate stem cells? That means you're rejuvenating all your major systems in the body. Yeah, and that's why a lot of people with cancer and other conditions got better. So good for you, Ann Wigmore. You were ahead of them all, but now they're catching up and verifying with science what you were doing through common sense and intuition. Finally, blueberry extract could help fight gum disease and reduce antibiotic use. This is in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. We know that gum disease is a common condition among adults. And what happens is simple. When you have bacteria, you form biofilms or plaques on teeth. And the consequences of this are gums become inflamed. In some severe cases, this is the periodontitis conditions. These are acute inflammations, and then you're going to have antibiotics. Because if you don't, bacteria and viruses from your mouth can migrate to your heart like all cytomegalovirus, and you can end up with heart disease. So what happens in that mouth as far as hygiene is very important. And so you want to keep the mouth clean and reduce inflammation and hence the need for antibiotics. And a lot of people also have some degree of gum inflammation, and that's called gingivitis. And that's caused by dental plaque. So the gums get red and swollen, and they bleed easily. In fact, once I was counseling a group of models who all seemed to be having the same problem. I wished you could have been there, because it was about midnight and I was counseling until about 1 in the morning over on 83rd and Broadway, where I was for decades, up on the third floor there. And it's always quiet night, and that when I can really focus on helping people. And there were three women. They were all in their mid-20s. They were all very famous models. They've been on the cover of all the major magazines. Now, to see someone without the hair and the makeup and the photoshopping and the gowns and all this, you see them for what they really are. And not that that's bad. It's just so much different than if the people don't see you the way you actually see yourself each day before you get into this makeup. And you would never know that they were models. That was what struck me. I'm looking and saying, what makes them look so different? And then you start realizing how much time and energy just to do a single shot. If the average person had this much time and energy and skilled people working on you, you'd look different too. And one of them made a comment that she had chronically bad breath. And another made a comment that her gums were always sore. And I said, you're in a relationship. She said, yes. I said, and so are you aware of what that can do in a relationship? She said, no. I says, go over to the mirror. Now open your mouth. Take your forefinger and gently massage your gum. So everyone's over there looking in the mirror, and she's massaging the gum. Suddenly you see this blood coming down, little bits of blood. I said, now that blood is very toxic because it's pooled in there and it has bacteria growing in it. And the bacteria causes a bad smell. But every time you kiss your partner, your blood and bacteria are going into their mouth. And that's infective. You could make them sick. That's a very serious... And they said, oh, that's gross. I said, do you know most people have bleeding gums and don't know it? They don't know it. Most people have receding gums, where the gum starts to go up and you start seeing more of the teeth. This is because of poor diet, lack of mineralization, mainly boron, phosphorus, calcium, magnesium, in a form that comes together with isothiocyanates, and bioflavonoids, and make really healthy teeth that are hard and healthy gums. And your most important nutrient for healthy gums would be vitamin C with bioflavonoids in equal amounts, same time, generally 2,000 milligrams, 4 or 5 times a day. And then your gums no longer bleed, they don't recede, they can come back to normal, your teeth are stronger, and you don't have to worry about that. And to get rid of the bad breath and have healthier teeth, first, if you have anything that's highly acidic, like I recommend lemon water, but just make sure if you're having any kind of citrus like lemon, you got to brush your teeth right afterwards, because otherwise that's acidic to the enamel. And even if it's very diluted, but just make sure that you just wipe your teeth down. If I'm out and I'm traveling and I have my lemon water in the morning, I just take a paper towel and I just wipe down the teeth. But otherwise, just take a toothbrush, and you don't even need the toothpaste, just toothbrush, because it's the agitation of the surface that makes a difference. Like I see people, when I just got off the plane, I went in to wash my face and hands before I went out to catch a cab to my location. This is just 3 days ago. And I'm watching guys go up, half walked out of the stalls without washing their hands. That's gross. And those who were using the stalls came up, and none of them, not one of them I saw while I was standing there, used soap. They just stuck their hand under. Okay, here's a little lesson. Well, I'm clean. Are you? Yeah, I'm clean. How do you know you're clean? Well, I just wipe my shoes on the outside, mat before I come in your apartment. Good. So your shoes are clean. Yeah, I wiped them. Then take your shoe off and lick the sole of your shoe. Oh, you mean that it's not that clean? You wiped, but you didn't wash your rear end. So if you wiped, is it clean? Yeah, I don't think so. In fact, in one recent study, they tested the seats of a movie theater in California, and a new movie theater, and it had over 3,000 fecal contaminations per seat. Wow, how'd that happen? It's simple. We are not a nation that values cleanliness or hygiene. And everything sweats, and as things sweat, it permeates right through cloth and materials and comes right out. Got to understand that. So washing with soap and water, not antibacterial soap. Never use antibacterial soap. It's worthless and it's dangerous. But regular, just simple soap. But it's the soap and the agitation. It's the scrubbing that disinfects and cleanses. So if you were filthy dirty, you're working all day in a garage, you had grease on you, you had sweat and dirt. Okay, fine. That's part of what happens when we work. Now you go in a shower. You jump in for about 30 seconds with water and you jump right back out. Are you clean? You didn't use soap. You didn't scrub. You just got some water on you. You're not clean. You have to use soap and water and clean. And it's the scrubbing of your hands. It's that friction, moving them back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, scrubbing, 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 and then with soap and under the fingernails as well. Otherwise, you might as well plant some sprouts underneath your fingers and just walk around and see about 5 days later you've got about 4 inches of sprouts. Someone want lunch? Well, that's how much dirt's under your fingers, and you've got enough dirt under your fingers that if that were to get in some stranger's body, that could kill them. Now, that doesn't mean we should be phobic. We are not living in a sterile environment. And exposure to natural microorganisms are completely natural and fine. But what's in another person's body, all the viruses that come out, all the bacteria that can come out, that isn't fine. And that makes a lot of people sick. And it kills lots of people. And all you have to have is a weakened immune system, and then you see it. So my suggestion is that scrub your hands with soap and water under your fingernails, just like a surgeon does. And do you want to know the irony? Thousands of people died this past 12 months who got infections from surgeons who didn't thoroughly clean their hands. I'm sure they used some water. No one just walks into surgery without using something, but it wasn't thorough. And so when you realize how easy it is to pass some really pathogenic bacteria, then you want to clean. And just think of those people now down in Rio. Wow. They're going to be swimming in water. Now, when I was down in Brazil and we were in the jungles and studying the indigenous culture and all that was going on, the person who was showing me all this that I needed, I didn't have the context, but this person did. I won't mention who it was because they were high up in the area that I was investigating. We're on the top of a roof. These are all small buildings, generally about six stories, right across the street from Ipanema Beach. There's Ipanema and Copacabana. Beautiful people and wonderful people, and the views are spectacular. He said, whatever you do, don't go in the water. I said, why not? Look at the ocean. It's beautiful. He said, do you see every single street has one of those little, one of those little tiny bumpy bridge? I said, yeah. He said, that's raw effluent going right into the ocean. It's untreated. I said, why is it untreated? He said, because we're so selfish in Brazil, and the rich are so stupid in Brazil, that we want to make as much money we can and spend it on ourselves, but we don't want to donate a penny. This is what he's saying, right or wrong. He's saying we don't want to devote a penny to something that can help everyone. And as a result, so we have these stupid arguments, and we don't put in the filtration to clean up our water before it goes into the ocean. As a result, everyone goes in there, and he said every single day people show up at the hospital with hepatitis from that water. He said, so the irony of it is we're paying all this money to live in a place that we only can partially use. We can enjoy its view. We cannot go in the water. Well, has that changed? Not at all. So the Olympians are going to be swimming in that water? Yeah. And there's going to be, didn't they just pull a dead body out of there yesterday? Yeah. And didn't they measure it and found out that there's all kinds of bacteria and viruses in that water that we would never allow anyone in America in any environment to swim in the water, as we didn't the Hudson River for decades because it's so polluted. Yeah. But we're going to let Olympians in that water. And they say, yes, you know what the advice was? Must have got this from the head of the Democratic Party. Keep your mouth closed when you're in the water. Makes sense to me. Hey, if you're an Olympian and you're swimming, what better way to swim then hold your breath and swim the entire race with your mouth closed so you don't get any water in your mouth? Makes a lot of sense. Wow. Wished I'd have thought of that. Well, there's going to be an awful lot of people gulping down an awful lot of water. And then let's see, about three weeks later, all these hepatitis and other diseases that they're going to end up having in their body. So this is the politics of the Olympiad. Stupid to the extreme. So use blueberries to reduce gum inflammation, reduce antibiotic use from it. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. To welcome all of you from all over the world who are joining us, continuing with our final part three of mandatory vaccines, what it means. We're looking at the whole idea that vaccines should be efficacious, meaning they should work. But what proof do we have? What standards have they used? Has this been determined by independent scientists who have no vested interest? The answer is no. Hence the injection deception, deconstructing the science and myths of vaccine efficacy. We're going to look at the whooping cough, that's also known as the pertussis. The vaccine for pertussis, better known as whooping cough, is packaged together with diphtheria and tetanus. As a result, it's called the DTAP, and given accordingly to a robust vaccine schedule of 5 injections by the age of 6. It is the most administered vaccine in the childhood vaccination schedule. You get it at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and 15 to 8 months, 18 months, and then 4 to 6 years. Despite regular administration of booster shots, the scientific evidence now suggests the vaccine does not effectively confer immunity against pertussis. As one recent study published in Clinical Infectious Disease put it, quote, pertussis is currently the least well-controlled vaccine-preventable disease despite excellent vaccination coverage and 6 vaccine doses recommended between 2 months of age and adolescence, end quote. Question, did you see this anywhere? Peer review, major study, independently done, showing it doesn't work? No. The ineffective nature of the pertussis vaccine was brought into sharp focus when California witnessed a dramatic rise in whooping cough cases. Over 9,100 people, many of them children. A study assessing the vaccine efficacy discovered that an extraordinary high 80% of all children who contracted the illness were fully vaccinated. One explanation for the pertussis vaccine's remarkable lack of efficacy can be found in a 2010 study undertaken by Penn State Center for Infectious Disease Dynamics. The team found that the whooping cough vaccine promotes the colonization of Bordetella pertussis causal bacterial agents. Based upon their findings, the researchers posited that the whooping cough vaccine itself may be contributing to the marked and resurgence of whooping cough cases compared to the previous decades. So the vaccine is actually causing whooping cough. Further evidence casting doubt on the whooping cough vaccine's benefits was presented at a 2013 meeting of the CDC's Board of Scientific Counselors, as well as the Office of Infectious Disease. During the meeting, CDC officials pointed out that the widespread use of the DPT vaccine has given rise to a more virulent pertussis strains. What's novel about these new emerging strains is they lack what is called a pertussin, the antigen current pertussis vaccine's target. The meeting's participants noted, quote, vaccinated patients had significantly higher odds than unvaccinated patients of being infected with these deficient strains, end quote. Therefore, the unvaccinated were safer than the vaccinated. You didn't hear about it. Another recent study surveyed the incidence of whooping cough in 8 states. The survey found that fully vaccinated children were 2 to 4 times more likely to contract the PRN-deficient strain than the unvaccinated population. Now, another reason for the pertussis vaccine's failure to control communal infections is because vaccinated children may become asymptomatic carriers of the pathogen. There is strong evidence that vaccinated populations may be infected with a whooping cough but not present symptoms. The serious downside to this is that asymptomatic carriers, meaning they're not showing any symptoms, can transmit the disease to unvaccinated individuals, especially infants who run the highest risk of suffering complications from pertussis. It also gives credence to a new research implicating vaccinated older siblings, not parents, as the primary source of infection for whooping cough among infants. This research runs counter to the entire notion of herd immunity, which states that older populations must be immunized in order to protect infants who are not old enough yet to receive the vaccine. In lay language, what they don't tell you is that once your kid has been vaccinated, for weeks or even months, they're shedding the virus. out of their nose, every time they sneeze and cough, every time they touch their hands to their mouth or nose, and then touch any object, a doorknob, anything, they're passing that contamination on. Now let's look at the measles. The efficacy of the measles vaccine has also come under serious scrutiny in recent years. In 2014, Dr. Gregory Poland, editor-in-chief of the journal Vaccine and founder of the Mayo Clinic Vaccine Research Group, published an alarming statement that the measles vaccine has a poor efficacy record. Despite 95% measles vaccination compliance among children entering kindergarten and the CDC's propaganda that the MMR vaccine has defeated the virus, measles outbreaks continue to increase, not decrease. And during the first half of 2014, there were 16 large measles outbreaks in the United States. And Dr. Poland does not believe this is due to unvaccinated individuals, but because the vaccine's failure to confer immunity. And during the first 6 months of 2011, there were 118 cases of measles reported to the CDC from 23 states in New York City. There were no deaths. Among the 118 cases, 105 were both, quote, import-associated and unvaccinated. Of the 87 U.S. residents who came down with measles, 74 were unvaccinated, 39 were age 20, and the rest were older. The CDC focused heavily on the unvaccinated measles victims while giving no time, zero, to the analysis of those who vaccinated themselves, were given vaccines, and who became ill. In fact, 13 of the group, that's 17.5%, had received all their vaccines for the MMR, but got measles anyway. And while the CDC uses these incidents of disease outbreak to stress the need for vigilant adherence to the vaccine schedule, the real take-home message here is that 17.5% of a group of fully vaccinated individuals got sick despite getting the vaccines. So one thing, however, is certain. All of the unvaccinated people who came down with measles now have a lifetime immunity against measles. For those who became infected despite having been vaccinated, we just don't know. Could the vaccine prevent these people from developing normal immunity throughout their lifetime? We don't know. No research has ever been taken to prove that. And likewise, a 1985 measles outbreak in a Texas community found that 14 students out of 1,806 who contracted measles were all fully vaccinated, no exceptions, and no reports of exposure from a foreign endemic area of any of the students. So that means that you had people fully vaccinated who came down with the disease. Now let's look at chickenpox. The chickenpox vaccine is yet another example of a failed vaccine. The present vaccine was licensed in 1995. Following its release, an estimated 25% of children were still spreading the varicella virus or getting ill themselves. Ann Gershon, a chickenpox expert and director of pediatric infectious disease at Columbia University Medical Center, says, quote, "We really need boosters of vaccines much more than we thought we ever would." Well, hello, this begs the question. How many boosters would be enough? Our vaccines do not confer lifetime immunity. Therefore, to compensate for vaccines' limitations and steady decline in providing immunity, more and more boosters are required. Consequently, in 2006, the CDC recommended that a second chickenpox shot be added to the childhood vaccine schedule. Gershon says, quote, "Looks like a second shot will keep children from getting sick." Looks like? Do you have any proof of it? Has there been any studies? No. This is just what happens with vaccines. We're told one thing, only to find out something completely different. Research into the efficacy of the varicella inoculation, however, has increased skepticism about the vaccine. In 2005, South Korea mandated the chickenpox vaccine to all children under 15 months, regardless of the country's 97% compliance, well above herd immunity's claims to eradicate infectious disease, chickenpox infections have not declined. Rather, between 2006 and 2011, there have been a 300% increase in chickenpox cases. American research has also yielded proof of a significantly higher rate of vaccine failure despite its widespread administration. And finally, the mumps vaccine. The mumps infection is another virus frequently found in vaccinated populations. In 2006, the U.S. experienced the largest nationwide mumps epidemic in 20 years, primarily infecting students on college campuses. Authorities attempted to blame these outbreaks on crowded dormitory conditions instead of considering the obvious. The vaccine simply is not effective for very long. In 2009 and 10, New York and New Jersey witnessed over 1,500 mumps cases among highly vaccinated groups. 88% of infected children had received at least one vaccine. 75% had received the recommended two doses, yet they still came down with the mumps. According to Dr. Jane Zucker, New York City Assistant Commissioner of Immunization, quote, "We know that approximately one in every 20 people who are vaccinated may not develop antibodies. The mumps virus can mutate, so people may have had only one or two doses of vaccines remain vulnerable." Yeah? How can a vaccine with such negligible immunity not only be recommended but required for school attendance? It is certainly reasonable and responsible to suggest that if a vaccine were proven to be safe and effective by a gold standard of science, it would be an important health service for every child and adult. However, after spending more than 15,000 hours over the last 10 years studying, writing, producing documentaries on vaccines, I have yet to see any such gold standard. Let me just put it a little differently. Let's just say that you were eating an unhealthy diet, not exercising regularly, and not dealing appropriately with stress. And so you got sick. Now let's say that you started to add something. Let's say you added some vitamin C. And a year later you thought, wow, this year I didn't get a cold. What if you then wrote an article saying, the cure for the common cold in all people is vitamin C? No one would publish it. It would have no credibility, and rightly so. Because you cannot say that because you took a certain item, that item by itself is what caused you not to get sick. Because we know that when people don't get sleep, they get sick. Maybe you got better sleep. Maybe you weren't in a relationship and were depressed. Now you're in a happy relationship that stimulates feel-good hormones and better biochemistry. There's so many factors that contribute to wellness, as there are many factors contribute to disease. And yet, virtually all of the science on vaccine is flawed for this one reason. If, let's say, 100,000 people were getting the flu vaccine, and at the end of the year, a certain percentage did not get the flu, they're going to give 100% of the credit to just that vaccine without any science study at all. None, zero, not a single study saying, what did these people, let's say these 1,000 people, what did they do that might have contributed to them not getting the flu? They're not looking at your diet, your nutrient levels, your immune levels. They're not looking at exercise, stress management, quality of life. None of that are they looking at. So they're giving all their statistics upon a myth, a legend. Take your vaccine, it creates antibodies. How do you know? You've never done the studies to prove it. If you doubt me, call the CDC and say, this last year, how many of the children that received the measles vaccine were given 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12-month follow-up with antibodies? How many antibodies did they have? Were they all the same? Were they different? How do you know those antibodies are protective, since the actual science shows you can have antibodies and get the disease or have no antibodies, not get it? As a scientist, as a public health advocate, I am embarrassed by the stupidity, the hubris, the manipulation of public health information, all to make money. And then all the people get in line and believe in a myth. the myth that vaccines have been proven safe and effective. Neither is true. Now, maybe in an individual, maybe a vaccine may have some merit, but we can't prove that. We haven't proved it. And every time there's been mistakes, they've covered it up. They covered up all those deaths and all those paralysis by changing the name of polio. And then they also eliminated a vaccine that caused over 40,000 cases of polio and deaths. And the public was none the wiser. So we have political science, we have economic science, we have proprietary science. What we're lacking is honest science. I'm Gary Knoll, and that's our special report. It is posted on my Facebook. It is posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com as well. Now, to add just a final thought on this, I wanted to share this very short piece that I received. It says, quote, "A growing number of parents across the nation are now going against the recommendations of the CDC vaccine schedule, which currently promotes the injection of 49 doses of various vaccines before a child turns 6 years old. The number of parents opting out of the onslaught of childhood vaccination has doubled since 2009. As vaccine use plummets, state legislators are trying to find new ways of bullying parents in the vaccine cycle. A new bill in Ohio, HB 564, seeks to intimidate parents in vaccine compliance by forcing them to be re-educated about the benefits of vaccine. One parent's group will no longer be allowed to send their children to public schools unless they see a state-licensed medical doctor first to receive vaccine re-education. If the parents object to a vaccine and determines it's not worth the risk to their child, they will no longer get to make the choice freely. This law will put parents under the control of the medical system by denying any philosophical exemption the parents may have. Since vaccines are a medical procedure, informed consent should always be required. However, if this law were to pass, the government could make extremely risky medical decisions without parental consent. HB 564 allows school administrators to vaccinate children with no parental consent if officials deem it necessary. In effect, the state is claiming ownership of children's bodies, trampling on natural rights and convictions of parents." That's how bad it's getting. And next up, I believe that within the next year to two, we will start seeing now in California, why should I be surprised about anything stupid from California, where they will now mandate all adults get vaccinated. And of course, the same cast of motley characters, all with financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry, will be there. And a governor who is compliant with anyone who benefits him. What an embarrassment. Wow. But maybe that's what we need. But please, let's make it all happen first to the corporate Democrat and liberal community. I'd love to see, you know, the people who believe that we need not just a village, but a state, a nation, and mandated laws to raise a child. Why don't they get all their vaccines all at once? Mandated. Then see if they have any objections. Because until we're in enough pain, we're not going to change. And unfortunately, unlike in some places in the world, we're not in enough pain to change. Not yet. Hopefully, one day, the state has the power. Now let's listen to this person's experience. This is a real person and not one of the doctors willing to pass a state law because they met with a private group that can influence their re-election and future employment. This is just a normal citizen.
My beautiful son, Dominic, who will be 16 years old, has been given a diagnosis of autism that comes along with a 50% chance of survival till the age of 22. He suffers from grand mal seizures, from OCD, from a lack of ability to talk. And this all came from vaccine injury. my beautiful, healthy, developing baby boy who played with his sister and used to call me mom and his dad papa and his sister dada and eat healthy food and use utensils and run around like a normal little child, received 6 vaccines just shy of his 2-year-old birthday. And I watched him develop 105 fever, seizures, and dissipated into a life of what we're calling autism. From not being able to talk anymore, to never hearing him say mom again, or be able to eat the way he's supposed to, or play with his sisters, or his brother, being condemned to a life of discrimination, wrongful denials, people staring at him because he's stuck in a wheelchair, thousands of seizures, jumping in pools to get him out of the bottom, countless IEPs of people telling me that he can't when I know he can, and that that precious little boy still has a beautiful mind and a wonderful soul that just on the outside is damaged from what the vaccines have done to him. And CDC knows. Center for Disease, they know. His medical diagnosis is viral encephalopathy. His brain scans show viral encephalopathy. His blood work shows NK cells and immunological markers of a cancer patient. That is what the vaccines did to him. And yet, the industry and our country wants to call it autism when it's vaccine injury. And the world needs to know. I've been trying to tell the world since I was 23 years old when it first happened. We entered the National Vaccine Injury Fund, and we were told because it was autism, he wouldn't qualify. And we're still in the National Vaccine Injury Fund to this day fighting to get the real diagnosis of viral encephalitis, because that's what the vaccine did to my son's brain. It really sucks. They don't just destroy the child, they destroy the whole family. It destroys the mother. It's like watching your child die in front of you. And you can't help them. And you feel helpless. And we can't keep destroying a generation of children. Because that's what we're doing.
Just one of millions of parents. These are real people. They're not play-acting like they care, like politicians. So she should know, in her desperation and in her pain, there are those of us who have sought the truth, and we know the truth, and now it's sharing it. That's why I'm advocating everyone today, download the article and share it. I have 3 documentaries. The Silent Epidemic, Autism Made in the USA, and Vaccine Nation. They're on YouTube. Share them with as many people as you know. The more we do, the more people become informed. Hopefully a percentage of those people will choose real science and the examples of other people to prevent them from having the same nightmare that this woman is going through. That's important. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen in today. I'll be helping our sister station in the next hour raise some funds. And for everyone else, have a great day.